Today I'm going to complete some discussion of the Middle Ages and how they came to an end and evolved into what's normally called the modern period of history, and especially how the nation state, the most important politico-economic unit of the past five centuries, came into being. And let me just give you a little slogan that I find very helpful. I didn't invent it. It was actually the statement of a historian named Charles Tilly. And Tilly wrote a famous article many years ago called War Made the State, and the State Made War. And that actually has been a kind of inspiration to me, because long before I read Tilly's article or knew very much about the early modern period of history, I had studied more recent times, and I knew very well that states make war, but I had not appreciated enough that the nation state itself was the product of war making, a kind of unintended development that came from the kinds of violent ambitions that have existed for thousands of years, but never gave rise to anything like the modern nation state before. It's good for us to remember that states are essentially about the use of violence. Nowadays, many people are likely to think about governments as some kind of grandfathers. They're like people who take care of us, who are interested in our welfare, whose only concern is to help us and protect us and come to our assistance and give us all those things we cannot give ourselves. But those beliefs are the product of propaganda, and they have no reality. And states are now, as they always have been, fundamentally based upon the capacity of some people to exert violence. And if they lack that capacity, they would simply cease to be the state. They would be replaced by other people who do have that capacity. And I'll talk a little later today about this contest between groups of violent people who compose states, and how it turns out that sometimes they have large areas to dominate and sometimes only small areas to dominate. Some nation states are huge, some very small. But all have the same fundamental character. They must. Now, toward the end of the Middle Ages, a long period of progress, economic progress, intellectual progress, technical progress, growth of population, increase in number of towns and commerce, all those things that began around the 10th or 11th century in different parts of Europe, continued into about the early 14th century. But starting about one-third of the way through the 14th century, various parts of Europe began to experience population crises, where diseases began to kill a lot of people. And eventually, after a few years, the most terrible of all epidemics ever to strike Europe, known as the Black Death, did make itself evident all over Europe and continued to ravage the populations of Europe for a long time afterward, sometimes the Black Death is dated exactly in the year 1348, but it didn't actually happen all at once like that. It happened at different times in different places, but around that time, this plague, the actual disease is known as bubonic plague. It still exists in some parts of the world. It's never been completely wiped out. But like many diseases, it would come and go. Epidemics have a way of curing themselves. They kill so many people that there aren't many susceptible people left after a while, so they stop spreading rapidly. And if they can't find enough new victims, then they diminish and retreat back to an endemic status instead of an epidemic status. And that did happen in the case of the Black Death, but it took a long time to happen. Between the year 1000 and the year 1300, roughly, a period of three centuries, the population of Europe increased by more than 100%. In the beginning, around the year 1000, Europe's population was approximately 40 million. And by 1300, the population was more than 80 million. So that's more evidence of the progressive character of that period of history. Many good things were tending to happen. Now, if we had been living in that period, we might not have noticed, because the rate at which they took place was still very slow compared to the rate at which economic progress occurred in the 19th and 20th centuries. But nonetheless, by the long historical standard, it was a period of very good economic performance viewed in the long term. But these demographic crises of the 14th century brought all of that to an end. Killed many, many people. Entire towns disappeared in some places. Remember, hundreds and hundreds of new towns had appeared in Europe early in this past millennium, and some of them just disappeared. Others had their populations greatly reduced. Sometimes when people became afraid of the Black Death, they would try to escape from it by running away into the countryside or to another town. And in some ways, that was the worst thing they could have done, because when they moved around, they were actually carrying the disease vectors with them and spreading it to other people. But they didn't understand what was happening, of course. They did not have anything like modern knowledge of disease causation. So they had to view this as the work of the devil or bad luck or something else beyond their comprehension. Now, one important economic repercussion of these terrible events was that when the amount of labor declined so greatly, the land they had been using remained unchanged, so the ratio of labor to land declined greatly. Labor became relatively scarcer as a economic resource than it had been before the Black Death. And as a result, many lords, many monasteries operating estates found they couldn't get anybody to cultivate their fields to do the work. So they began to compete to attract workers and to offer them better terms for working, which is to say the wage was bid up by competition. Now, this kind of competition was not so obvious as we might see in a modern labor market where almost everybody receives money wages, and it's easy to get a lot of information about how much is being offered by different employers. But the word did spread that better terms were available in some place than the peasants were getting where they were located. And so they began to move around in response, even though, of course, they weren't, according to the existing institutions, free to move around. They were supposed to be bound to the land where they were born and the Lord for whom they had worked before. But nonetheless, they would take a chance, just as many of them had previously taken the chance to escape from these manors into towns, where a custom developed that if they managed to stay in the town for more than a year, then they were free. The German saying, a town heir makes free. So serfs knew about the possibility of escape from their bondage, but it was dangerous, of course. If they were apprehended, they might be punished. And so it took some courage to make that move, but many people had enough courage to make it. So the laborers began to move around. The employers began to offer better terms, that is, higher wages, whether they were paid in kind or in money or in some other way. Now, a result was that at the same time, many of the payments that had been made to lords in terms of goods, payments by serfs, the lords decided they would actually prefer that the serfs pay in money. Because during that long period of economic progress, one of the things that Europeans had discovered was the products of the Asia and the Middle East. They learned about them sometimes from the Crusades that began at the end of the 11th century and took a lot of Europeans to Palestine, where they discovered the things that the Muslims were consuming, including goods from farther to the east, and they liked what they saw. They found nice textiles, silks, cottons. That was nice for people who had only woolens. They found beautiful things, jewelry, works of art. They found things that were amazingly good, spices, because at that time European food was terrible. It tasted bad. It was often rotten and tasted worse as a result, because there was no way to store food well. And so sometimes people had to eat spoiled food because it was the only food available to them and it didn't taste good. But the use of spices allowed them to make even partly spoiled food taste much better. So they wanted to get their hands on these spices as well as get their hands on some of these luxury goods from Asia. And to do that, they needed money. It wouldn't help if the peasants delivered chickens and handed over some of their wine and some of their grain. It was difficult to exchange those kinds of products for the products of the East. So the lords began to commute, the word we use, to commute the payments in kind into payments in money. And especially they began to make the serfs into tenants. The serfs, rather than paying payments in manorial dues paid what amounted to land rent for using the land controlled by that particular nobleman. So then the Lord collected some money and was in a position to go out into the market and buy things that he would enjoy. So we have here a much more rapid development of the money economy in Europe starting in the 14th century. It begins to spread even into the rural areas. Before, the money economy had been confined almost entirely to the towns and to the dealings of merchants. Of course, they had used money all along because money is so much better as a medium of exchange than any kind of ordinary commodity. That's how money is defined. It's the commodity that has the lowest cost of use as a medium of exchange. So money use had never died out, even in the darkest days of the Dark Ages, but it had become quite uncommon when people were highly self-sufficient and there was very little trade. So these developments were important precursors for a revival of the European economy, but it did not begin for quite a long time because these demographic horrors lasted for 100 years or more, depending on which part of Europe we look at, and a large part of the population disappeared. Now, in the 15th century, we begin to see changes in the nature of the political units. Before that time, control of areas had been very small. Local noblemen had controlled areas of maybe a few kilometers across. They defended that area themselves. They had a horse, an armor, and a lance, and a battle axe, and some other weapons they knew how to use, and it was their job to fight off anybody that tried to come and interfere with the area they controlled, if they had the courage to do it when the need actually arose. And to assist the defense, they usually built a castle, very fortified buildings with walls and sometimes with ditches and moats full of water, sharpened poles, anything that would make it difficult for attackers to get into the castle. And then if they were not able to fight off the attackers, they would retreat into the castle and wait. They would have food stored there and other necessities, and they would simply wait. Attackers might besiege them, just set up camp outside the castle and try to starve them or wait for diseases to kill them or for some other event to weaken them. So warfare in the Middle Ages usually involved just waiting and didn't involve a great many days of fighting compared to days of waiting. And the outcome of military confrontations was usually decided not by military skill, but by the course of disease on the two sides. Because whichever side died off first, lost. So I know in the movies it looks more glorious, but it was pretty hideous in reality. Sometimes the attackers would give up after a while, deciding it wasn't worth it, or too many of their soldiers had died, or they were running out of supplies for themselves, or some other thing would discourage them. So that was the way these little fiefdoms, these small political economic units, conducted military action. Now, starting in the 15th century, there were changes of two kinds that were critical for altering the balance of military power. One kind of technical change was technological. The Europeans finally managed to use gunpowder, which the Chinese had invented hundreds or thousands of years earlier, but the Chinese only used gunpowder for fireworks, for fun. They didn't use it for military purposes. The Europeans adapted it to military purposes and used it as an explosive propellant placed inside a metal tube, which we know as a cannon. And when they exploded the gunpowder, they could propel some projectile out of the tube at great force. And so the development of effective cannons in the 15th century really changed the balance of military power. Because now attackers could come to a castle, set up some cannons, and simply bombard its walls and break them down, gaining entry without an extended siege. Now, perhaps thicker walls would help, but even very thick walls with the technology of those times might still be battered down by sufficient artillery fire from cannons. So the cannon tilted the balance. But, of course, cannons were big, expensive pieces of equipment, even more so than the equipment the knights had used. Of course, a suit of armor was expensive, and the weapons that a knight fought with were expensive, but not so expensive as a dozen cannons. So in order to make use of this new weapon, they needed more money to buy the cannons or to pay the makers to build the cannons for them and to provide the gunpowder, the cannonballs, the apparatus for moving the cannons around and putting them in place where they could be used effectively. So now the noblemen that could get a lot of money together could get the best military force. Well, how was he to get a lot of money? Of course, they'd always wanted a lot of money, but every time they went out to try to get more by conquering the people next door, they found they had no advantage. It was one knight against the one down the road who had the same military capability as the attacker, more or less. But the more successful noblemen who were able to accumulate enough money to buy cannon and furthermore to equip a lot of soldiers with pikes, these long, very tough spears, sometimes with axes attached to them partway toward the end, and to train pikemen to operate as a close unit so that dozens of them together would attack simultaneously with their pikes out. They became a very effective infantry unit if properly trained. But that was expensive too. You had to support these soldiers by hiring them, paying the people who trained them, and then keeping them equipped and fed and supplied, awaiting warfare. So those noblemen who were able to train and equip pikemen, add cannons, and keep the money coming in, usually by some bureaucracy they created for the purpose of systematically collecting tax from the people they controlled, they were in a position now to overcome all of these isolated knights with their castles. And they proceeded to do that. See, what we're seeing here is now war is making the state. Somebody had enough of a head start to make war successfully, and he was able to build a bigger domain with a bureaucracy for tax collection. And so now we've just about created the modern nation state. An effective army and a tax collection bureaucracy almost define the modern nation state. But of course, those princes who first developed an effective nation state were then in a position to defeat anyone they came to who had not developed an equally effective means of resistance. So the natural tendency of these warrior rulers was to continue to expand their areas of control so long as they could. And this would continue until they met a sufficiently powerful counterforce, or until their area of control got so big that they were no longer able to administer it effectively. Just as the Romans found they couldn't control everything out on the periphery of their empire, kings found they couldn't control everything in a big bureaucracy. Or if they conquered a lot of new areas, they wouldn't be able to know what was going on everywhere, and so they would become ineffective at defending those areas against other states that might be moving in from other directions. So what we have shaping the size of the political units in Europe is a kind of contest going on. As military technology and the ability to raise money give some people the ability to push out, but as they do so, there are natural limits on how far they can push. Just as in a modern firm, if the firm gets too big, it becomes inefficient because the managers no longer can keep track of what is being done by all the employees. And they may shirk, or they may misappropriate the firm's funds, or they may misbehave in other ways. So there's a natural limit on the size of a business firm, given by what's sometimes called the span of control. Well, the nation state had an issue of span of control also. It couldn't get just as big as the prince wanted to make it. And these people began, of course, to call themselves kings and to act accordingly, with a big, lavish court full of well-dressed noblemen kowtowing to the king providing entertainment for him and keeping him amused when he wasn't thinking about the next war. So if you look at the treasuries of the early modern nation states and say, how is the money spent? About 90% of it is spent directly on the military, on war making, and practically all the rest of it is spent on the lifestyle of the king, on the court and his favorites and all of his followers and flunkies. So this is the good life for a king. Of course, there is a downside. His brother may assassinate him. So there's always some kind of risk in life. You never really have it made. So this was the war made the state, and the state made war. Now, by the 16th century, this process had brought into being some very large nation states. Spain, certainly the English, had something that was not so far away from this already, but they consolidated it, and France, and farther to the east in Europe, we still had a lot of small political units, not so well consolidated, although some were starting to consolidate even there. All right, well, this kind of brings us up to around the 16th century, and at this point, the Europeans are still eager to get access to Asia for the goods that they might obtain by trade there. But now they have a problem. It's not a new problem. The Muslims have been at work since the 7th century, and they've spread their empire all over northern Africa and even up into Europe in the Iberian Peninsula, which they controlled completely for a long time. But as of about 1500, you see the indication of the Ottoman Empire here. And it's interesting that the Ottoman Empire, not exactly, but approximately, covers the same area as the old Eastern Roman Empire, and was, in a sense, its replacement. Remember that the Eastern Roman Empire did itself disappear in the 16th century or 15th century. 15th century. So the Ottomans have taken over the Muslim world and spread their rule up into the Balkans, almost to Vienna. I suppose your ancestors were getting worried with all of these Turks on the way. But this kept the Europeans from trading easily with Asia, because all the trade routes through the Levant, through Palestine, that had previously been used by the Venetians and by other European traders, were controlled by or blocked by the Ottomans. So many of the Europeans were eager to find some other way to trade with Asia. And some of them had dreamed for a long time of an alternative route. Instead of going overland through the usual trading routes, they thought there might be a way to reach Asia by sea. And it wasn't that Columbus was the first person to ever have that idea. Many Europeans had thought about the possibility, and the conditions just became ripe in the 15th century. But the idea was to break that Ottoman barrier by finding another way. Now, in order to do that, they had to have more abilities to navigate and to sail in the oceans than they had. And in the 15th century, they developed their technology of sailing and navigating sufficiently so that they could succeed in these ventures. And ironically, much of their success they owed to the Arabs, from whom they took, for example, the design for sails, for ships. European ships had previously used square sails like that, or rectangular sails. That's okay if the wind isn't too rough or the wind isn't too violent, and you don't have to tack, that is, sail against the wind. If you need to do that, then you need triangular sails. And the Arabs had developed triangular sails, something known as the lateen sail. And in the 15th century, the Europeans adapted their sailing ships so that the rigging combined some square sails, which were the strongest for propelling the ship when the wind was favorable, along with some of these lateen sails, triangular ones, which were more helpful when the wind was very strong or not blowing in the right direction at all, so that they would have to move diagonally against the wind and wait for a more favorable wind to come from behind them. But they built these new ships, some of them known as carracks or caravels, and they proved to be sufficiently seaworthy that navigators could go for thousands of miles in the open ocean without worrying that the weather would sink the ship for sure. It still might. These were still little ships and very fragile by our standards, but They were much more seaworthy than the previous European ships. Europeans also developed in the 15th century better maps, charts showing depths of water, showing the locations of different land masses. They improved the compass so they could tell their directions more accurately, and they developed a better astrolabe, the instrument that they used, also taken from the Arabs, to determine their latitude, where they were located in a north-south direction on the earth. They still didn't have a good sense of where they were in the east-west dimension of the earth, but they had to work on that for a long time before they were able to create good instruments for that. The Portuguese turned out to be the leaders, starting in the early 15th century. A ruler known as Prince Henry the Navigator, with a great interest in discovering ways to Europe, to Asia, and an interest in subsidizing. Here we have kind of one of the public policies that has persisted ever since, and that is rulers paying subsidies to entrepreneurs to get them to do things they wouldn't otherwise find promising, profitable. So this sort of adds some income that they can be sure of. And now all governments in the world pay subsidies of some kind, often to different kinds of businesses, different kinds of enterprises, as well as subsidies. In Europe, of course, many people are paid family allowances. They're subsidized just for having children. They don't have to personally bear the full cost of the expense of child rearing. So subsidies are a public policy that was perhaps not unknown before Prince Henry the Navigator, but he certainly made active use of subsidies. In his case, he wanted to subsidize improvements in navigational techniques, and he wanted to subsidize exploration so that people would be able to just go out and find what was there. And the Portuguese began to do that, and they continued to do it throughout the 15th century with great success. First, they went out to the Madeira Islands in the Atlantic. Then they went to the Azores, a little farther away. Then they came down the coast of Africa, and they discovered one place after another. And in some cases, they found opportunities for trade in Africa. So they didn't have to get to Asia. They were already able to trade in Senegal for gold and for slaves. And this was the beginning of a slave trade in which Europeans were active participants from that time in the 15th century on into the 19th century, when slavery was finally abolished and the slave trade was terminated, legally at least. So this was another byproduct of the Portuguese explorations. They also started in Africa a sugar colony. And of course that became an enormously big business after the Europeans had come to the Western Hemisphere. Sugar was the great colonial export of the 17th and 18th centuries. And most of the slaves that were brought to the Western Hemisphere were brought to work in producing sugar. Sugar grows best in tropical climates, and tropical climates proved in the Western Hemisphere hostile to the health of slaves and the conditions they lived. And as a result, many of them died, which meant more slaves had to be brought from Africa to replace them. And so that process went on for centuries. By the end of the 15th century, Portuguese explorers had gone all the way around the southern end of Africa and discovered that, yes, it was possible to reach the Indian Ocean by sailing around Africa. So now it took very little time for others to follow, to go to India, to go beyond India to the area that's now Indonesia and the East Indies. And there they found everything they'd been longing for, the Spice Islands, opportunities to trade and bring back wonderful products that had an active consumer demand in Europe. And so the Portuguese established a number of trading posts. They weren't much interested in colonization or empire building. They were more interested in protecting their fleets and establishing trading posts. And so they did that over a long area along the coast of Africa, back up the east coast of Africa, in India, in the island of Goa, in the East Indies. And so the Portuguese were king of the world for a short while. Now, on their heels, of course, were the Spanish, because the Spanish were well aware of what the Portuguese were up to, and so they began to send out their own explorers. They conquered the Canary Islands to get started, and then they went on, of course, when the rulers of Spain consolidated their power. Aragon and Castile, two of the largest areas of the Iberian Peninsula, consolidated with the marriage of Isabella and Ferdinando, and that completed the in 1492 the expulsion of the Moors happened, as well as Columbus' first voyage to the so-called New World. Now, of course, it wasn't new. Not only was it populated by millions of people, but Europeans had been there before too. The Norsemen came to the New World as early as the year 1000. And they even stayed there for a while. And when the Norsemen established their colony in Greenland, which lasted for four centuries, they routinely came to the New World and got wood, because there was no wood in Greenland. So this tells us something about how slow information was to filter around Europe, because it appears, I've been trying to find out if Columbus and the Genoese and the Portuguese navigators really knew anything about what the Norse had done. I found no evidence that they did. And so this might as well never have happened, so far as they knew. They were still taking a gamble that they could reach Asia by sailing west. And of course they could, but not right away, because something was in the way, North and South America. And so that's what Columbus blundered upon in 1492. And then later he made other voyages, four voyages altogether, to the area now around Central America and the Caribbean Sea. And unfortunately, he did not find Asia with its wonderful products, spices, fine silks and cotton fabrics. He found some relatively poor native people in the area he visited, but not far behind him came other Spaniards who found really great things. They found the Aztec civilization of central Mexico, which was itself an empire. The Aztecs were the rulers of many other tribes they had subdued and forced to pay tribute to them. So they had become very, very rich and had accumulated great stores of gold and silver, some of it made into beautiful jewelry and other products. So when Cortes came to Mexico City in 1519, He must have thought he had died and gone to heaven, because here was all this wonderful treasure before his eyes, and he was keen to get his hands on it. And he quickly figured out how to do that, because the Aztecs had many enemies, all the people they had subdued. And now he was able to enlist those other people on his side and easily, amazingly easily, overthrow the Aztec rulers and take control of the Aztec Empire. And then the Spaniards began to haul all of this loot back to Spain, greatly enriching the nobility of Spain. Now, not long after Cortes, Pizarro found the Inca civilization of Peru, and that was also tremendously rich with great amounts of silver. And in that case, again, the Spanish conquistadores were able to overthrow great empires with tremendous ease. When I read the stories of these Spanish conquerors, I still can't believe them. First of all, it's hard to believe the audacity of these men at even thinking they could pull this off. Now, they were a handful of people, and never more than 200 Spaniards in one of these raiding parties. And these Indians are by the millions. They could have destroyed the Spanish very easily, but by a series of coincidences that favored the Spaniards, they were able to overthrow two empires in just a few decades, take control of the area, and begin to exploit the native people. Because even better than hauling off all the loot that was lying about was the fact that in both Mexico and Peru, the mines for producing silver were unlimited. So the Spaniards could set about to making the local people work at mining silver and then bring that back to Spain. And they did that in great quantities in the 15th century, making Spain the most powerful nation state in Europe, because it had all this money to buy military forces. And that allowed Spain to subdue other areas, much of Central Europe, Southern Europe, even up to the Low Countries. So the Habsburg Empire spread itself all over Western Europe as a result of the treasures looted from the New World. Now there's a policy lesson there. Looting can be a very profitable policy. Nation states still loot when they can. When the USSR defeated the Germans in World War II, they looted Germany. They took entire factories back to the USSR. They hauled away everything they could put on a train. So looting is still something that nation states will do if they can profitably do it and get away with it. It's not this old-fashioned thing from the 16th century. Right now, my country, the United States, is imposing itself on a big area of Southwest Asia, which it's going to more or less loot, because it's going to take control of the energy resources of that area. It won't do it quite as blatantly as the Spaniards took back the treasures of the Aztecs, but if you cut through the paperwork, you'll find it's still engaged in looting. Now, this Portuguese and Spaniards had been so successful at reaching out to the wider world that other European nation states immediately tried to imitate them. And so the French and the Dutch and the English quickly got into the same act, And the first way they did it, of course, was not by going to the New World to find their own treasures, but by lying in wait for the Spanish ships and taking the treasure they held. So English pirates, when pirates have a license, they're called privateers, and that that means they can't be hanged by just anybody who catches them. they're legal pirates. They might still be hanged depending on who catches them, but at all events, privateers were licensed by the monarchs of England and France to go out and prey upon the Spanish treasure fleets. And the oldest city in what is now the United States, St. Augustine, Florida, was actually established in 1565, and it was put there by the Spaniards as a place from which they could better protect the treasure fleet as it passed each year on its way back to Spain off the east coast of Florida, where English privateers would try to capture these rich prizes, and sometimes did. So now we get all the Western Europeans reaching out to loot or prey upon somehow the treasures of the New World. The British were rather late to get into the business of establishing themselves in the New World. Their first attempt took place in the 1580s. They sent some people, they weren't sure where. The maps were very poor. We now know they sent them to an island off the coast of Virginia, Roanoke Island, and we also know that they all disappeared. So nothing is known about exactly what happened to them. They were probably all killed by natives, but no one knows for sure. But the next attempt the English made did not come until 1607. And at that time, James the First had become King of England. And James was a very interesting monarch. He had not only the usual monarchical ambitions of extending his territory and control and winning wars, but he was a great proponent of reaching out, of bringing opposing interests into some kind of harmony, especially if he could decide what kind of harmony. But one of his ways of doing this was to authorize friends, or sometimes enemies even, to form companies to explore the New World and to establish settlements for trade there, trade or plunder. And it was that endeavor that caused him to establish the Virginia Company in 1607, which established the first permanent English colony in North America. Now these colonists were greatly disappointed. First of all, because they almost all died in the first 2 years they were in Virginia. They didn't know how to survive there. They had come as basically a military unit. They didn't know how to grow crops successfully in that area anyhow. So they ran out of supplies. They had no easy way to get new supplies from Europe. So they just died of disease and hunger and starvation. But their numbers were replenished after a few years. And fortunately for them, many of the indigenous people were sufficiently friendly that they learned from them how to grow certain crops successfully, such as how to grow maize, this North American corn that's now grown all over the place. But the Indians had been growing that themselves. They taught the English how to do it and how to find food. So gradually, after great suffering, the English colony did survive in Virginia. But the greatest disappointment was that there was no big Indian civilization there to loot. There was no treasure of the Aztecs or no silver mines of the Incas. There was nothing like that. The Indians of Virginia were relatively poor. They had nothing of value to take. And so that meant that the English either had to go back to England or they had to find some other basis for remaining in Virginia. And again, the Indians came to their rescue because the Indians used tobacco, another local plant they had made use of for a long time, for inhaling its smoke. That you know, if you've never thought about the idea of inhaling the smoke from a plant, it's a pretty odd idea. We're all used to it because we see it from the day we're able to take notice of what goes on around us. People are inhaling smoke from a dried up plant. But that was a bizarre thing that the Indians did, and the Englishmen noticed, they tried, and they liked it. And you know, there's a long history that follows that, because they thought this would be a good thing for them to use to sell back in England. Other people might like it. So they began to carry tobacco back to England, and sure enough, people loved it. They loved it. You know, just like an 11-year-old kid wants to smoke. You know? The English all wanted to smoke tobacco, and they took up the habit readily. Now, that meant that the Virginians were in a position at least to produce an export product and earn income and provide a basis for their life in the New World. Of course, they had to also grow some food and other things that had to be taken care of, but their mainstay, their comparative advantage, turned out to be the production and export of tobacco. And this product, more than any other, provided the foundation upon which the English colonies of North America succeeded. Because even in colonies that did not grow tobacco or did not grow very much of it, the more northerly colonies established later, people there still were involved in the tobacco trade, because they built ships, they provided shipping services, and they provided other trade that they used to support the tobacco commerce of Virginia and Maryland. And so that became the foundation of economic life in North America. I think Americans are ungrateful now to hate tobacco as much as they do. There would be no United States without tobacco. They should honor it. They don't have to smoke it, but they should honor it. It's what sustained them and made them possible as a nation. Now, after Virginia, the next colony had nothing to do with royal favoritism or anything of the sort. It actually, strangely, had something to do with religion. And it was the colony of Plymouth, which was established in 1620 by a group of dissenters, religious dissenters, that had been persecuted in England for decades, at least from the time of the Reformation onward. Now, of course, England had its own Reformation, starting with Henry VIII in the earlier part of the 15th century. But Henry VIII's Reformation had not been very thorough. Basically, Henry VIII's Reformation involved Henry VIII looting the church and taking the monasteries apart and hauling off the metal roofs, which were made of copper, and selling the copper or taking anything else he could find that belonged to the Church of Rome. So Henry VIII did establish the Church of England, and it pretended to be Protestant, but it was really still very much like the Church of Rome, the Roman Catholic Church. It was just subservient to Henry VIII, not to the Pope. But at the same time, other Protestants wanted to go much farther, particularly the followers of John Calvin. They wanted to be much more thorough about the Reformation, and so those people became the dissenters of England. And the Church of England persecuted them mercilessly for many decades. Well, now we have a group of these people that decides what it would like to do is just get out of town. And they didn't mean Holland. That's where they sometimes had to run for protection from the crown. But they wanted to try their luck in the New World, to set up their own little society where they could worship as they pleased without interference from anyone else. And, of course, they had no interest in religious freedom. That was not their aim at all. They didn't want to give religious freedom to anyone who disagreed with them, and they were quite ready to persecute any Catholics that showed up or any Quakers or anybody else. But these Congregationalists who founded the Massachusetts colony certainly wanted their own religious freedom. And so they got the king to authorize them to come and found such a colony, basically to get them away so they wouldn't be bothering the Church of England anymore. It was cheaper than putting them in prison, perhaps. At all events, they came to Massachusetts, and they too almost all starved to death for the same reason. They didn't know what they were doing. They had no knowledge of the place they'd come to. They didn't know how to even survive there, much less to prosper. And once again, they were rescued by Indians who helped them. Indians taught them how to find food, how to grow corn and squashes and other farm products that they could use as a diet for themselves. So the Massachusetts people had a great period of hardship, but after 10 or 15 years, they began to get on their feet and to look for ways of finding an export product. And in their case, the exports tended to be more from the forest. The forests of New England had many good, straight, tall trees that would serve as masts for ships. They had other products such as pitch from the pine trees that could be used as part of the maintenance of sailing vessels. Turpentine could be made from pitch. And turpentine was a product used to clean paint off of surfaces so they could be refinished. And all these things had to be done on ships all the time, so the products of the forest could be used by the New Englanders, lumber, masts, and these other things like turpentine and pitch, which were known as naval stores. So they began to export those, as well as to use their skill as sailors and traders, and to trade not only along Massachusetts, but farther down the coast of North America, to Virginia, and even to the Caribbean Sea, to the islands where other colonies had been established, not just by the English, but by the French and the Dutch and the Spanish. And even the Danes had established some colonies in the Caribbean. So these New Englanders became traders, and their farms were never very good because the land of New England is not very good for agriculture in most places, but they still did some general farming to help them survive. Other colonies had different bases still. Some of them were religious havens. The colony of Maryland was a gift to Lord Baltimore, who was a Catholic. And for some reason, he had enough standing in the court at the time that he was allowed to establish this colony where Catholics would be free to practice their own form of worship without molestation. So he did. And Maryland lies just above Virginia, just north of Virginia. It's a small colony, but in the 17th and 18th centuries, it was important because a lot of tobacco was grown there and exported. Eventually, farther to the south, the colony of Carolina was established. And there, other products were discovered. The colonists discovered they could grow rice because it's semi-tropical in Carolina. They found indigo, which was a plant that could be made into a beautiful red dye that had a strong demand in Europe. So they began to look around for what economists call their comparative advantage. And everywhere the colonies were established, a different kind of comparative advantage was found. Something that could be produced there at relatively cheap cost compared to the resource cost of producing it elsewhere. And that produced a basis for trade. And the people who established the plantations in these areas eventually accumulated considerable wealth. By American standards, they became rich by the 18th century, some of them, but by European standards, none of them was ever what you'd really call rich. I'm sure that some of the big English country houses would enclose all of the great plantation houses of the colonial Americans, because nothing on that scale ever appeared in America. But they certainly prospered, and the general population prospered compared to the general population of Europe. Common people could come to America and find the possibility of economic advance that was difficult or impossible for them in Europe. And so it created an incentive for them to come. Now, how were they supposed to get here if they're poor people? They can't afford to pay a ship captain to bring them to Virginia or Maryland. How do they manage this? Well, they devised a wonderful form of contract, one that's still used occasionally in various forms, known as an indentured servitude. The indentured servitude was a contract in which a person desiring passage across the ocean traded his labor power for a specified period of time in exchange for the services of the ship captain to bring him to the New World. And these contracts could be written in all kinds of ways, but they were legal, written, binding contracts. If someone violated them, either party could go into a court and ask for enforcement of the contract. And so they actually had good legal standing in the English system of law that had developed. Other forms amounted to trading one's children's labor for passage for an entire family. The English did not usually come in families. They usually came as individuals. And, of course, usually the people who came were young people, because young people not only have a greater willingness to bear risk, but young people had a much longer time period to reap the gains of the price they were paying to invest in passage to the New World. An older person wouldn't be here long enough to make it pay to be an indentured servant for 3, 4, even 7 years. Indentured servitude often bound a person to work for 7 years. And at the end of that time, it might provide for some some of money, some piece of land, some suit of clothes, some set of tools to pursue a trade. It just depended on the contract. Often the indentured servants were taught some skill, some trade. So when their servitude ended, they became freemen, able to pursue their calling and having skills to do so and earn more than a common laborer could earn. But again, many people were just children. Some were not even servants by choice. They were simply put there. In London, men would walk around the slums just snatching little kids. Kids that were orphaned, perhaps. They would go into the prisons and they would just take prisoners and put them on the ship. And they'd say, you know, be glad. You're going to Virginia to be a servant for 7 years. It's better than staying in this stinking prison. Which it was, usually. Most of the white people who came to North America, to the British colonies in the 17th and 18th centuries, came as indentured servants. Most Americans don't know this. They don't know how their ancestors got there. They think they just boarded a ship, you know, like taking a cruise on the Caribbean. But not so, because most people did not have enough money to afford to pay to bring themselves to North America. So they had to sell a period of their working lifetime in exchange. Now this other system, it was called a redemptioner system, and involved an entire family. And when people from the German areas of Europe began to migrate in the 18th century to the colonies of North America, they often came as redemptioners. Redemptioners came as families, and they would, when they reached North America, basically put their children up for auction on the docks. And people who wanted servants would come and buy, 5 years of little Johnny's labor and haul him away. So these people are there watching their kids. Bye, Johnny. See you in 5 years. Taken away into servitude, but they had no other way to finance the family's passage. And it is true that often, when their terms of service ended, the families did reunite. They found each other again. So it was not always a sad story, but sometimes it was. Especially for those little kids that were just hauled away as orphans or against their will. People were sometimes kidnapped and sent to the New World. So the New World was populated by adventurers, and poor people, and the dregs of society. people who had the least standing, the least wealth, and a handful of wealthy people who could afford to make investments and to bring themselves, their families sometimes, to North America. Eventually, by the 1740s, 13 of these British colonies had been formed, stretching all the way from Massachusetts down the coast to Georgia, the area that's Florida still belonged to the Spanish at that time. So we got all of these colonies going, each of them looking for a comparative advantage in engaging in international commerce, and eventually living quite well, and left alone for the most part by the British government. Now, the British government did have an empire, so it had rules about how the empire was to operate. For example, when you exported something from the colonies or into the colonies, you had to take that product through England. You couldn't take a product directly from France to Virginia or from Italy to Virginia. You had to first take it to England, unload it from the ship, and then load it on another ship and take it to North America. If the Virginians wanted to sell tobacco to the French, first the tobacco had to go to England, be unloaded, stored, reloaded onto another ship, and taken onto Europe. Now, if that seems like a stupid system, it was a stupid system from the standpoint of the whole society. It was wasting resources to unload and reload and store products that could have been taken directly from their starting points to their destinations. Why do you think they would do such a stupid thing? Why do governments ever do stupid things? Governments do stupid things when they feel it's in the interest of the government to do stupid things. And that explains practically everything modern governments do. Practically every subsidy paid by a modern government is a stupid thing. We should not be diverting resources to uses that won't pay their way in the market. That's a waste of resources. But by subsidizing resources, we divert them from their most economic use into a less economic use and waste value. Okay, why did the English do this stupid thing of having what was called the enumerated products? Well, because who gained from this? The people who got income from handling the products as they passed through England. Merchants in England who had some political influence with the government exerted themselves and got the Council of Trade, which made rules for the empire, to make rules stating that you had to bring everything through England. And of course, duties were collected, and that meant some more revenue for the English state at the same time. So this was a form of robbery, but that's no surprise. But the colonists had to put up with this. One way they put up with it was by smuggling. Americans have always been great smugglers. Many of the American revolutionaries were notorious smugglers. The man who signed his name so big on the Declaration of Independence, John Hancock, was a notorious smuggler. He said, "I'm signing it so big so King George will be able to read it without his spectacles." That's when you know you're involved in a revolution. When you've given up all attempts to conceal your identity and your actions and you announce, "I am going out to oppose the government." All right. Well, there were lots of smugglers. That's one way they dealt with this problem. They brought products directly from Europe all the time, or they took products directly to Europe. But smuggling was hazardous because the British Navy was large and actively engaged in trying to apprehend smugglers. And so it was a big risk to smuggle. So that did mean that many people decided that rather than taking that risk, they would just obey the rules and send their products to England and then have them transshipped onto the continent or some other place. So smuggling was only a partial solution. But other than that, the British Crown did not interfere too much in the life of the colonies. They enjoyed what was called benign neglect, and it's kindly neglect. They went far away from England. They seemed insignificant in the beginning, so no one much cared about them. Eventually, they got much richer, but they were still far away, and they managed their own affairs for the most part. They established their own legislatures in each of the colonies. They made rules for their own political conduct. They had royal governors that were appointed by the crown, but even the royal governor could sometimes be bribed or bought onto cooperation with the local people. So they were not always a problem. And the colonists lived their own lives for almost two centuries in the case of Virginia, and for a long time in every colony. So they got used to managing their own affairs, and they did not like it if the British government decided to impose new rules on them. And that was the problem that occurred after the end of the Seven Years' War. Because that was a very large war, and the British had spent a gigantic amount of money in fighting the Seven Years' War. They had been victorious. Among other things, they had dispossessed the French from North America. But they were very much in debt. And so they thought it only right that the colonists, who had been protected from the French menace, contribute to paying some of the costs of the British state and helping them pay down their debt. So they began to put new taxes on the colonies, and they began to change the rules in ways that made it easier for the British to find tax evaders. And some of their ways were really resented greatly. They had this writ, a court ruling called a writ of assistance, which was basically an open-ended search warrant. And a British customs officer would get a writ of assistance, which meant he could go in your house and just look around, looking for anything, looking for contraband goods, looking for any evidence that you were engaged in smuggling, look through all your papers, look at all your products. He didn't even have to know what he was looking for. Maybe he was just playing the lottery that he'd find something there. But this kind of intrusion into people's homes and their businesses, the colonists hated this. They thought this was tyrannical. They were supposed to be Englishmen with the rights of Englishmen. A man's home is his castle, was their saying. They were supposed to have firm private property rights at that time, and the crown seemed to be ignoring their rights, attempting to tax them, and threatening even worse things to come. And it was that threat of worse things to come that really inspired them to rebel. And that's where I'll start next time.